time to take a short break, which is called for in the program, and then we can use the second part of the afternoon to go into both panel discussion and audience participation. So the topic this afternoon then is the condition of Alaska Natives today. The participants are all identified by a rather glorious sign, which gives you an opportunity to look in your programs and to look into their academic backgrounds and to see that they are all singularly qualified to speak on the topic this afternoon, having all had active involvement in various issues in Alaska. Now, the condition of Alaska Natives today is a topic that is much spoken about and broached in many circumstances, and it is my impression that it is not always done with the same amount of assurance, or the same amount of certainty. And one big problem I constantly notice is a problem of lumping the peoples of the various regions of Alaska are lumped together in the appellation, the natives, with very often a total disregard of the differences, the regional differences that exist in terms of habitat and economy, also the cultural differences, which are still very, very real, then the historical differences, both in terms of contact, length of contact, and nature of contact, also the differences in acculturation. And if we were speaking of a very small and homogeneous group that had sort of a uniform historical background, that wouldn't be too much of a problem. But we are speaking of an area that is very large with groups of people that had definitely different languages, different cultures. And so I find it very often very difficult to speak of the Alaska Native as one uniform group. Nevertheless, the last few years, it seems to me, there is emerging in Alaska a group of people who are exhibiting a certain number of traits which I think they exhibit not because of their own choice, but because of a reaction to, I think, attitudes and expectations which they see in the people all around them. And so it seems that in the past, whether we intended it or not, we have thrown our cultural net over the people in Alaska, and we have brought them into our cultural situation, and now there they are, very often finding themselves between two worlds, between two cultures, or I sometimes like to describe it as orphans of two worlds. Now, these situations are due to a factor which Dr. Hippler will speak about, namely migration and urbanization. It is also due to the health situation, which I think, unbeknownst to a good many people, has been really a strong acculturated force in Alaska due to the fact that many, many people were forced to be absent from their communities for lengthy times and therefore became acculturated and acquainted with a good many other factors and cultural situations. And this is obviously true for the economic situation. And Mr. Arnold will tell us about the various differences in the economy, and therefore will, I'm sure, highlight some of the differential situations in this particular condition. I am sorry to have to announce that Dr. Valene Smith will most probably not be with us, and in that case, Mr. Salisbury will be willing to read her paper, or at least to summarize her paper for you. So the condition of the Alaska Natives today then, whether it is in terms of self-perception, in terms of migration, in terms of the health, or in terms of the economics, is what we would like to explore this afternoon. And it is my pleasure to call then first on Professor Hippler of the Institute of Social, Economic, and Government Research, who will speak to us about patterns of migration, urbanization, and acculturation.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lines. There are several problems in attempting to present any so complicated a phenomena as migration, urbanization, and acculturation in a very short order, so I'm not even going to try to really cover it all. First, I'll preface my remarks by saying what I'm going to do is to boil down most of the major issues that I'm attempting to deal with in this paper and add a few more to them, with the caveat that you have to keep in mind all of the time that essentially I'm talking about northern and western Eskimo populations. Although some of what I have to say is true for Athabaskan Indian groups, not very much of what I have to say is directly true for Tlingit Haida groups. So, the interest that one might have in looking at the whole pattern of migration and urbanization in Alaska, as far as Alaskan natives are concerned, could stem from at least two relatively distinct bases. One, a general academic interest. It's an interesting problem for an anthropologist. But two, it's also a very serious problem in terms of developing public policy. In this sense, I'll try to pull both of these together. Excuse me. Now, in the distant past, the population of the areas that we're discussing actually lived in a quite different way than it does now as far as the settlement pattern is concerned. The settlements were either isolated, people lived in very small groups, sometimes only two or three families living together, which would come together at various times of the year for festivals or for various, perhaps for summer hunts of certain types. Mostly, though, Eskimo life in the past was in very small bands. This changed as service groups, missionaries, school teachers, hospitals, and so forth, and some degree of cash work was made available in these areas. As they did, more and more people began to move into smaller communities, which really took on the quality of villages. There were very few villages in Alaska, at least among Alaskan Eskimo groups, that are very old. There are a few. Tigara, Point Hope is one of them. Kotzebue is another, but there are very, very few. Most of the villages that now exist are relatively recent in origin and owe their existence to the beginning of a trader who set up a post there, or a missionary, or a school teacher, or any number of them. This change has been assumed, I think, by many people to have a very definite kind of follow-up, that people will move from these small communities into ever larger communities, and from these larger communities, such as Barrow, Bethel, and Kotzebue and Nome, into places such as Fairbanks and Anchorage, which I assume are seen as more or less the end stop of the acculturative process of Alaskan natives. This is in part true. On the other hand, one of the more interesting things that has come out of the most recent research I've been able to do is it isn't really completely true, and that the actual picture is much more complicated and has some very serious policy implications. People are leaving the small villages at a fairly substantial clip. Lots of people are going. Lots of people are migrating into Fairbanks and Anchorage. On the other hand, looking at the population curves of the villages right now, if you make a composite population curve for all of the villages on which I had myself had available age-sex data, it does not show, one, that there are more women leaving villages than men, which has been a sort of a belief that many of us have had for a while. It also does not show that there's a serious enough out-migration of young adults to suggest that the villages are going to disappear. Now, if I state this as if it were more dramatic than anybody might believe, it's because in the past, and certainly in the recent past, a great deal of what passes for state and federal policies directed towards Alaskan natives has been based on the assumption of the inevitable and rather quick disappearance of Alaskan native villages. If this is not to be so, that means that highly expensive kinds of services are going to have to continue to be provided for people who live in very outlying and remote regions. This is something that will have to be taken into consideration. Part of the reason why you build a hospital in a larger area, or part of the reason why you hope that you can get people to move to larger communities, is to cut down on administrative costs, if you're concerned with administrative costs, and anybody administering a program is. If, however, you have to face the fact that not only will the large villages, such as Barrow, Kotzebue, Bethel, and Nome, continue to increase in size through time, but that most of the villages are going to remain and probably also increase in size through time, and that in addition to this, a substantial urban population in Fairbanks and in Anchorage, as well as perhaps Juneau, is going to develop, then a whole new dimension of problem exists. Now, to diverge somewhat from the paper that I was going to give, I think it's important to talk about why, in fact, this might even be a problem. Other people have at length, and I have myself, and other times, talked about some of the difficulties that Alaskan Natives face in the process of acculturation. I think these are relatively clear now. The business of being on the receiving end of about 100 years of people telling you that what you do and how you do it and the way that you live is backward and stupid tends to make a lot of people believe it after a while. It also means that you have a more limited access to education, since you're in many cases being taught by people who really don't expect you to achieve very much. It means that your whole self-perception is retarded. It means that your ability to have access to the greater dominant culture is more limited than those of whites. The policy problems that come about as a result of this are several. If people are moving into cities who come from a different culture than the dominant culture of the people who occupy those cities, they offer a difficulty in servicing. We know how very well to service people who are like us, social workers, school teachers, policy administrators have a pretty good idea how to deal with people that are pretty much from the same cultural background as them, even though there are distinct differences between class groups in the United States, and many lower class living patterns are quite different from those in middle class patterns. We feel more comfortably certain of how to deal with people who have, on the basis of what we assume to be the same skin color, the same kinds of general attitudes as we have. If people are substantially different racially and substantially different culturally, they offer problems in attempting for the administrator to understand where they're at. Now, where they're at may be a very peculiar set of places. When people come into Fairbanks and Anchorage, we have to assume, at least by now, it's beginning to be clear that we have to assume, that they don't really come into Fairbanks and Anchorage. Not in any of the ways that you or I may have moved into Fairbanks or Anchorage. When people come from small villages into Fairbanks and Anchorage, apparently they come into them by moving into a small community that already exists there of either their kin, people from their village, or people very much like them, who tell them what to expect of the community in terms of what they've already found. So that a very definite set of perceptions accrues to anybody moving into such a community. The kind of people with whom Alaskan Natives come into contact with in cities are not the broad cross-section of the people who live in them. They come into contact primarily with agency people, the police, and the more or less underside of society, bartenders, drifters in general, people who tend to be roustabouts or who are hangers-on looking for work, or construction men who are coming down from the North Slope or up to the North Slope. This is a quite different slice of American society than most of us are exposed to all of the time. So that there's this limiting perception that people receive when they come into the urban environment. We really don't know enough about this. Not much has been done on it yet. And I'm suggesting to you that the reasons that it's necessary to do something about it are both academic and policy. In terms of policy, you really have to know where people are at before you can do much with them. Now, as I said, this is diverging just a bit from what it is I had originally intended to present, so I'll try to summarize again and very briefly what I'm saying, because the quality of life is something that other people are going to be touching on. I'm just touching on a very important structural factor, which I think we have in the past overlooked. The migratory patterns that are occurring at present indicate that people are moving into cities and into large villages, but that this movement is not in any way going to ensure the disappearance of villages, that for every there's every strong reason to believe that the villages will remain viable units for the indefinite future. Now, the second part of this to remember is that people who are coming into the urban environment are not necessarily coming into the urban environment, but coming into a very selected perception of it, which means that in order to reach them, in order to permit them to make the free choice of what type of culture that they choose, what type of life pattern they choose to pick up on, they'll have to be given special consideration. There will have to be special kinds of programs developed to permit them to understand more about what it is they're really coming into. I'd like to just drop it for that, Bill, and come back to this in a question.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hippler. Now we will hear from Dr. Martha Wilson from the Alaska Native Medical Center.
I don't see anyone there to run that slide projector. I wonder, Irma, can you run that slide projector there for me? It seems...
No, but I can move on.
David, how about you?
That's going to be handy.
Yeah, right.
The screen.
Yeah, they're going to pull that screen down.
I've got to relinquish.
Oh, here's a young man who can do it. Fine. The overall health status of the Alaska Native people is a result of a composite of several different types of health problems. And most of these problems are bound up with issues that are not medical issues in the usual sense of the word. If I could see the first slide, please. Can someone turn the lights out back there, please? Whenever any public health person starts talking about health, the first thing they do is to describe it in terms of its total absence or death, and also in terms of its relative absence and diseases, and that's the way I think it's the easiest way to describe the circumstances we find ourselves now. This is a breakdown of 1 year of the age of death of the Alaska Native people in comparison with the rest of the United States. And you can see that approximately 19% of these the people died over the age of 65, whereas for the Alaska Native people, a large percentage of over 60 are for the rest of the United States, a large percentage died in old age. About 30%, this was in the year 1965, died in infancy, that is before their first birthday. And in comparison to the rest of the United States, it was about 5.1%. So part of the health status of the Alaska Native people is that it is characterized by premature death. Now, if I may have the next slide, please. They also die from a different set of causes. In some of their situations, they're comparatively much better off than we are if you were just evaluating this from the types of death. Diseases of the heart are much less among the Alaska Native people, but influenza and pneumonia are very high. And the leading cause of death, which doesn't even show because of a shadow here, for the Alaska Native people is very small in comparison with the rest of the United States, only 5.9%. We have an accidental death rate approximately 8 times the national average. And we have much less in the way of malignant neoplasms, much less in the way of diseases of the heart. We have great disparities that still remain in some of the infectious diseases. Okay, if I could have the lights now, you can turn the major infectious diseases that still exist here in great disparity are not those that are preventable by purely medical means. For instance, there are no vaccines to protect against pneumonia or meningitis or otitis media or bronchiectasis or enteritis. And we speak of planning and providing comprehensive health services, and I'll try to describe our efforts in such service. But for the diseases I've mentioned, medical prevention is impossible, treatment is difficult, costly, painful, and fraught with failure. And rehabilitation is hopeless when there is destruction of vital parenchymal tissues, such as the lung or the middle ear. In order to understand their health status, one needs to understand something about their history from a health standpoint. And the Alaska Native people are an Aboriginal people who are still relatively early in their contact with the cosmopolitan outside world. As such, they have followed until very recently the pattern of health response that most Aborigines have taken to their contact with outsiders. That is, first, they suffer from a series of acute explosive epidemics of infectious disease from which they had always before been protected by their isolation. Then these are called the virgin population epidemics, and they are much, much more serious in terms of death rates, in terms of morbidity, in terms of the incidence of disease, and in terms of total impact on the population, then the death rates are much, much higher. They leave very critical gaps in family organization and in community organization, and that leaves the grieving, disorganized, and weakened survivors to face the more slowly rising but even more ominous problem of tuberculosis. Many, many Aboriginal people have been wiped out by such series of events. But from a health standpoint at least, those circumstances are changing, and they're changing rapidly. The Alaska Native people have been unwilling to be the passive recipients of the same kind of fate that's overtaken so many other such groups. Their culture is such that it allows them, given their understanding and approval, to rapidly accept and use new concepts and new technology. They have participated actively and with increasing responsibility in the planning and carrying out of their health programs, and this participation is the cornerstone on which the health programs we are discussing now are built. Now, can I see some more, please? To understand our health system, I'd like to describe to you just what we have here. Since we're starting off and talking about healthy people, I'd like to just show you a beautiful young mother and her beautiful healthy child. This is one of the goals that we're hoping to reach. Okay, next. I'm sorry, I believe these are a bit out of order, but I can go ahead and show you this. These are some of the factors that are adverse that create a number of health problems. This is a factor in the housing. It is a contrived Fort Yukon stove built out of an oil drum. And it is in with a great deal of clutter around it, which is flammable. And this is one of the reasons that the accidental death rate is so high. Possibility of these homes going up in smoke is always there. In fact, there's a probability when this type of arrangement is there, okay? I'm sorry, I believe these are enough out of order that I better go on to just put the lights back on and turn it off. Our first effort is built with the village health aid. The health aid is responsible for all the health care activities during the long time periods of time when there is no physician or nurse in the village. She renders first aid and is the first point of contact with the villagers when someone is injured or becomes ill. She has had some training. Our program is only beginning to be a formal type of training. And she may get advice from one of the field physicians at the field hospital during the daily radio medical clinic. She helps the public health nurses, the dentists, and the physicians to organize their village health clinic. With the advice and support of the nurses and physicians, she institutes treatments for minor illnesses. And for the more serious illnesses, she helps to arrange for the transfer of patients to the hospital. The next level of effort is at the service unit hospital, where we have seven such hospitals being located throughout Alaska. The next level of effort is at the Alaska Native Medical Center, where we provide backup services to all of the remote and outlying field hospitals, plus having all of the responsibilities of a service unit of our own. Now, if one tries to group, and we're talking about grouping various things, we try to group the health problems that the people have into those that relate to the various adverse environmental factors. I'd like to discuss first the poor housing with its ensuing respiratory disease complex. The native housing is abysmally poor. Most of the homes are small, dark, badly overcrowded, poorly insulated, and unevenly heated. In the wintertime, heat is at such a premium that ventilation is out of the question. Sun shining through the airspace of any home can do much to purify it of even such hardy and stubborn pathogens as the tuberculosis organisms, but at this latitude, the sun does not shine for months at a time. Studies conducted in air raid shelters during World War II showed that the tuberculosis organisms could remain alive and viable and capable of causing serious disease for months at a time. Thus, the Alaska Native homes are unique in the extent to which they permit the dissemination of respiratory diseases of all kinds. It is small wonder, then, that they have suffered epidemics of tuberculosis, pneumonia, influenza, otitis media, meningitis, and bronchiectasis that have not, to our knowledge, been equaled in any other population. Tuberculosis is one of the few respiratory diseases for which a purely medical effort is feasible, though optimally even control of tuberculosis should be coupled, the medical effort should be coupled with a strong and effective effort to correct the environmental factors that I've just described. However, with aggressive case finding and treatment and careful follow-up and careful preventive measures, rapid gains can be made, as can be shown in the Alaskan experience, where the death rate has come down sharply, the incidence rate has come down equally as sharply, and the rate of dissemination of disease, which is a much more valid measurement of control of the disease, is even more dramatic. But for other respiratory diseases, and there are many types of respiratory diseases, the gains have not been so sharp. The pneumonia influenza group remains high, and about five times the national average. I've got this on slide somewhere. But the respiratory diseases still account for the leading nonviolent cause of death, and about 75% of the post-neonatal deaths are from pneumonia influenza. Some of the babies that recover from the pneumonia influenza experience do not recover completely. One episode of severe respiratory infection in earlier life appears to predispose to subsequent episodes and ultimately to the development of bronchiectasis, a chronic bronchopulmonary disease which is characterized by the dilatation of bronchi, by chronic and acute recurrent infection of the bronchi and neighboring lung tissue, and by loss of lung function in the diseased area. We've identified over 150 children by bronchographic studies that have severe bronchiectasis. Over 60 of these children have required surgery, and there are a small number of children, fortunately small, who have such extensive disease that surgery is not feasible. These children are already respiratory cripples, and their condition can be expected only to worsen. This incidence of disease apparently has no parallel in any other population. We've tried to compare this with other people in test centers outside, and they have no parallel experience. Another very serious respiratory type of problem is the otitis media. It is a chronic infection of the middle ear. It occurs in two phases, and if the acute phase is not treated aggressively and appropriately, it may progress to the chronic phase, and that is when the pus builds up in the middle ear and breaks through the eardrum. If this happens to both ears, the hearing is damaged and the children are significantly handicapped. The implications for this type of sensory defect on learning in children will be covered by Dr. Fleshman in his paper, but we have identified approximately 625 children with bilateral deafness on this basis, and these children require very special audiologic, otologic, and educational services if they are to expect any opportunity to achieve a satisfactory level of social or educational or vocational achievement. We believe that if we can provide such services, that we can successfully restore hearing to approximately 60% of these children. Another factor in the adverse environment of the Alaska Native people is the absolutely impossible situation with water and sewage disposal. And there are very significant disparities in deaths due to enteric diseases, Shigella, Salmonella, and pathogenic E. coli infections occur with considerable frequency. Infectious hepatitis also occurs disproportionately in this population. The other large area in which there are great disparities are the accidental disease complex. It has, accidents have been the leading cause of death since tuberculosis was pushed from the first place. A major factor lies in the rugged conditions under which men make their living and under which women try to raise children. Thus, a disproportionate number of deaths occur from drowning, firearms, and fire. Now, if one looks at their history, one sees in their immediate background a tremendous amount of family disruption, which has been brought about by the tuberculosis epidemic itself and by tremendous disruptions relating to the need for husbands and fathers to go away from the villages to work and for by the need of the children to go away to have an education. Recent studies in both family and community psychiatry have identified and emphasized unresolved grief as a factor in the development of mental illness. And we believe that we see a great deal of that in this population, and we believe that will only get worse with the progressive urbanization that Art has mentioned. That's a pretty grim picture, and we believe that the situation is serious, that the disparities that remain are still significant, and that the mental health problem remains as one of the larger and more unmet health needs.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. So now we have heard from Dr. Hippler on migration and urbanization. Dr. Wilson described the health situation. And now Mr. Arnold from the Federal Field Committee will describe for us some of the characteristics of the economy of the village.
Thank you, Dr. Lyons. When we see portrayals of Alaska's economy in various state publications or federal publications or by newsmen, they describe the importance of fisheries and minerals, oil and gas particularly now, and occasionally they'll mention the importance of the federal government, but often they ignore, that is, fail to mention, one sector of Alaska's economy that may be important to as many as 20,000 persons. This sector is that activity, that gathering activity of Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts, who gather food and fuel for their own subsistence. It's this sector which is most distinctively characteristic of village Alaska, and it's this gathering activity which helps define village Alaska for the purposes of these remarks. About 70% of Alaska's native population lives in predominantly native communities across the state. It is true, of course, as Professor Lyons has pointed out, there are many, many ways in which these communities are unalike, not only in culture, but in the size of place and the climate and the differences in landscape. But there are a number of ways in which these places are similar. They are typically small communities. They are usually situated along rivers and coasts of the state. A few are along the roads of the railroad. They typically depend heavily upon air transportation. They are governed usually by native councils rather than under organizations that have been established under state law as municipalities, for instance. The villagers are likely to use native dialects in speaking with one another. Their educational levels are likely to be low. As Dr. Wilson has pointed out, their health status is likely to be poorer than that of other Alaskans. They probably live in poor housing, though not all do, but they're likely to draw upon unsatisfactory sources of water for their water supplies. And finally, they probably live on the public domain rather than on land that they own. That was next to finally, really. Finally, back to the point I made at the outset, there are similarities in the economies of Village Alaska. First, incomes are low and prices are high. Second, there is that reliance upon gathering activities as a basis for subsistence. Third, permanent employment, in the sense of job holding, is more likely to be government employment than industry employment. And non-natives are more often holders of permanent, well-paying jobs, even in Village Alaska, than are natives. Fourth, more persons are seasonally employed than have year-round jobs, and unemployment levels are high. And fifth, welfare payments are of some substantial significance in the cash economy of Village Alaska. Now, since these are generalizations, characterizations about many villages, some important differences among places and among economies of places will be submerged, I fear. I think that my remarks largely, more accurately apply to Western Alaska, and it's in that area west of Anchorage and Fairbanks that the larger number of villages are located, some 130, I suppose, of 177 or so. Detailed price surveys aren't carried out in Village Alaska. They're carried out in the principal cities. But we do know that the cost of living is very much higher in the villages of the state. And in the larger native communities of Nome and Bethel, in 1968, prices were 71 and 85% higher than in Seattle. The causes of the high cost of living in Village Alaska are, I think, fairly well known. According to the chief economist of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, cash income needed for a typical family of 5 to 6 persons in most villages is $6,000 to $8,000 a year. Through various subsistence activities, this requirement may be reduced by $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000, but still the demands for cash are high. Incomes for Village Alaskans are far lower than required and far lower than for Alaskans generally. Two surveys carried out in southwestern Alaska and in 1967 showed per capita incomes to range from $600 per person to $800. In 1967, for Alaskans generally, family incomes averaged more than $10,000 or more than $3,600 per person for Alaskans generally. While the extent of dependence upon food gathering and other gathering activities varies among regions and among communities within a region and among families within communities, it appears that most Village Alaskans subsist in some measure by hunting, fishing, and trapping, by gathering berries and greens, and for some by using animal skins in making of certain garments and by gathering driftwood, timber, and willows. These varying patterns of gathering activities are described in John Abrahamson's paper on Westward Alaska by Dr. Scott and Christine Heller in their dietary survey of a few years ago in considerable detail. There isn't very much data showing the extent of reliance upon food gathering by Alaska natives who live in villages, but for 35 northern coastal and interior villages, where a survey was carried out by the Fairbanks District Office of the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And based upon these interviews, more than one half of the native adults responding said that half or more of their food supply was dependent upon hunting, fishing, trapping, and other gathering activities. About one of 12 said that all of their food supply was dependent upon those activities. Only one in four said none of their food supply was gathered. As I remarked earlier, in Village Alaska, government is the single most important provider of year-round jobs. And of the three levels of government, the federal government is of principal importance. In the 10 native census districts, predominantly native census districts in northern and western Alaska, which include 148 of those villages, in the winter months of 1968, just under half of the wage and salary jobs were in federal, state, and local government. During the month of January, for instance, wage and salary employment in those districts totaled 6,191. Government employment totaled nearly 3,000. In five of these districts, that's Bristol Bay, Bethel, Kuskokwim, Kobuk, and Nome, the number of government jobs exceeded all others. In those five districts, Of something over 2,700 job holders, almost 1,600 were federal, state, or local, in a few instances, local government employees. In the larger communities, the number of permanent job opportunities in government is greater, of course, because such places as Nome, Bethel, and Kotzebue are regional administrative centers for government. To speak to these communities for a moment, in 1968 in Bethel, of 491 people holding jobs, 300 were employed by government. In Kotzebue in 1968, of 523 people employed, 252 were employed by government. And in Nome in 1967, of 772 people employed, 289 were employed in government. In Bethel and Kotzebue, the federal government is the principal employer. In Nome, it is the state. Seasonal employment is a source of cash income to more villagers than permanent employment, and this is found chiefly in the seafoods industry and in government-funded construction. Though government's relative importance in Village Alaska as a direct employer is diminished during the summer, there is an increase in seasonal employment also that can be attributed directly to the activities of government. This summer, for instance, the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the state of Alaska were building school additions in 31 villages, and much or most of the workforce was being drawn from the local areas. In 12 villages, the state was carrying out road or airport construction. Alaska Village Electric Cooperative Incorporated was providing a few weeks of work in 24 villages. Construction for the Public Health Service, Operation Mainstream of Rural Cap, and others was also providing employment for opportunity for villagers to earn cash incomes. Forest fires on the public domain, we had many of them this year, also result in seasonal job opportunities. By mid-July of this year, more than 500 Eskimos, Indians, or Aleuts were employed by the Bureau of Land Management. To turn to unemployment, during the three summer months of 1968, the Department of Labor estimated unemployment to range from 11% to 20% in the 10 western districts of Alaska. Among the districts, the highest unemployment was 42% of the workforce in June in the Kobuk area. The lowest was 5% in the Aleutians. No formal estimates of unemployment and employment are made by the Bureau of Indian Affairs during the summer months, but the estimate made by the area office is that unemployment among villagers may drop to 25% or less during the summer. Though it's very clear that high unemployment is another characteristic of the economy of Village Alaska, even in the months of job opportunities, joblessness during winter months is even more severe. In January 1968, the Alaska Department of Labor estimated that 8 of the 10 predominantly native districts had higher unemployment rates than the state average of a little over 11% of the state workforce. And these figures, which show high unemployment in western Alaska, are generally agreed to be understatements, owing to the fact that to be classified as unemployed, a person needs to be in search of work, and the employment office may not be near, and the person may be informed, well, he will know, that jobs are scarce. So an effort to contact the employment office for assistance would be of little use. The Bureau does compile estimates of, the Bureau of Indian Affairs does compile estimates of unemployment and employment in March and September, though not in the summer. These are done by administrative units of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which include cities such as Fairbanks and Anchorage, not only what I'm calling here Village Alaska, where there is that great reliance upon food gathering. The two units that include only villages covering five census districts in western Alaska showed in March 1969 twice as many without jobs as job holders, or what you could call unemployment of almost 60% in the Nome District and about 68% in the Bethel District. And more than half of those who were employed in March 1969 had only temporary jobs. Turning to another characteristic of the economy of Village Alaska, welfare and unemployment benefits. Though unearned income going as welfare to Alaska Natives is important to Village Alaska as a source of cash, it is of less importance than I think is generally assumed by most people who talk about welfare in the village economy. These payments go to natives as to others who are old or blind, disabled, or who have dependent children. In addition, general relief is available to Alaska natives under the name of general assistance. This general relief, unlike the categorical payments I mentioned a moment ago, which go from the state, is afforded by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Having greatest impact of the several categories of programs is aid to families with dependent children, a program which puts about $1 million annually into about 750 households and villages. Villagers appear to require longer periods of assistance than other Alaskans receiving aid to dependent children. To turn to the Bureau's general relief program, welfare funds in the form of temporary relief from the Bureau of Indian Affairs amount to nearly $750,000 in the economy of Village Alaska. These funds go to native persons who are needy, but who are not eligible for those categorical programs, for the old, the blind, the disabled, and so on. This corresponds to what I call the general relief program for other Alaskans. There were, in 1967, something over 1,700 cases of persons who received temporary assistance from the Bureau. Another thing I mentioned, though it's not central to this, but because it's so often not known, is that the duration of assistance for so-called employables is generally of a short duration. For Western Alaska, for the years 1964-1967, about 61%, nearly two out of three of the cases, were helped for 3 months or less, and another 20% aided for from 4 to 6 months. Only 10% of those who were receiving Bureau of Indian Affairs and welfare assistance in those years were helped for 12 months, and most of these were not employable. In months that hunting, fishing, trapping, and other gathering activities can be carried out, there is a great decline in the number of persons receiving general assistance. Likewise, as jobs become available, even away from home, whatever welfare payments are being made to the so-called employables drop greatly. Unemployment insurance payments are probably of lesser significance than public or general assistance payments in Village Alaska, in part because the seasonal jobs upon which many Alaska natives who live in villages depend are of too short a duration. They don't fall into enough quarters to permit those persons to be eligible for unemployment compensation. I compared in the 10 native districts of the West and found unemployment insurance totaled less than $1 million, and total welfare, public assistance through the state program of welfare and Bureau of Indian Affairs temporary assistance to total nearly $2.5 million. For most of Village Alaska, it is generally agreed that the outlook for the next few years is that there will be but little economic change in the basic characteristics of the economy of Village Alaska, those features I have described, such as high prices, high unemployment, reliance upon food gathering, and so on. In the southwestern and northwestern areas, where most villages are located, present resource development opportunities promise only a small increase in the number of jobs or modest gains in income for a relatively small number of people. A number of things have been happening in the last 2 years to help develop some of those smaller opportunities where 5 people or 10 people will have jobs who didn't have them before, or where 4 or 5 dozen or even 100 will increase their incomes as fishermen through the use of cooperatives. When I'm talking about little change, I mean those big possibilities for transforming resources into jobs in large numbers. Such a resource development possibility, of course, exists in Western Alaska on the Kobuk River, but it's generally expected that this development won't take place within this decade. In the Aleutians, shrimp harvesting and processing are expanding and expected to further expand and create, again, some additional jobs. In the far north, and the subject of this conference, the oil developments in the north, industry spokesman told me that by midsummer some 2,000 jobs had become established, were existing in the north, and that perhaps an eighth or more, or maybe less, were held by Alaska natives, villagers, and others. The oil pipeline construction promises 2 or 3 year employment opportunities for maybe a few thousand men, some of whom might be migrants from distant villages. While migration out of western and northwestern Alaska villages may result in economic change for the migrant, unless it exceeds the high rate of natural population increase in those areas, it isn't expected to change basically the character of the economy. Some change in the economy of Village Alaska might be expected as the result of congressional settlement of Alaska Native land claims. It's not known what the forms of that specific settlement will take, but whichever one is settled upon for much of Village Alaska, the consequence might more likely be one of an increase in income, or it might be increase in participation shaping their futures, that is, the future of villagers, rather than a substantial alteration in the character of the economy. Another prospective development, that of income maintenance payments for the working poor and for other poor, again, would increase incomes, which increase is very, very much needed, certainly, but would not work a substantial change to the economy of Western Alaska. For most of Village Alaska, then, the immediate economic prospect appears to be very much like what it has been in the past. And I quote now from a letter from a Western Eskimo to a state legislator. Again, spring is here with us, and worker jobs are pretty dim in our area. Last year, all the men were without work all summer long. My total earnings for 1967 were less than $300, and that worries a man with a family of eight. We hate to get welfare, but it's our only solution sometimes. It is tough without work, and hunting only does not meet our needs. Sometimes we have bad luck even though we hunt. We have to worry what our next meal will be. But I really thank the BIA office in Nome for giving us help when help is most needed. Even though we hate to ask for help, our children give us the courage to write. Last year, we heard a fish buyer would be in our area to buy fish. We waited every day, anxious to commercial fish, but the fish buyer never came. So even though it was late, I went to Gullivan and fished, but it was there too late, so I did not meet my expenses. It has been a tough winter, but I am happy that spring is here. We heard again there will be somebody from Fairbanks buying fish. We should be informed in time so that we can be prepared. Employment benefits really helped us out last year. This time, I don't have much earnings in 1967, so I will not earn such unemployment benefits this year. There's over 25 men in our village, and not even one has work prospects. Only three have steady jobs. That's the store manager, the postmaster, and the BIA janitor, plus one BIA cook. We need help to get work. I know the labor market is scarce, but we should get training for the older men without high school education. Whether this letter of a Western Eskimo to his legislator is typical of villager sentiment as to the unsatisfactoriness of the village economy, or as to the range of possible remedies, can't be said with certainty. It does, I think, portray, remarkably so in a single letter, those principal elements of the economy of Village Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Now that we have heard three analyses of various conditions, I think we will be very much interested in seeing how this really influences the self-perception of the Alaska Native. For those of you who were late, I had to announce that Dr. Valine Smith was not able to be here, and so Mr. Salisbury, one of our discussants, has agreed to deliver her paper to us here.
I might add that the views herein expressed do not necessarily reflect the et cetera, et cetera. Not all of them. The Alaska Native is aware that his role in Arctic and subarctic is undergoing significant change and that his destiny depends in large measure upon his ability to once again call upon the age-old cultural ability to adjust, this time to a strange and at times almost hostile social milieu rather than to a rigorous physical environment. Basic to success in acculturation is knowledge of, one, the underlying roots of the historic ethos and material culture, two, a clear statement of the desired elements in the new culture, three, knowledge of the points of compatibility between the old and new values with associative recognition of points of variance, and four, a social and educative process that enables the affected native to understand the problems involved in transition and therefore his status in the period of change. Individuals caught in the maelstrom of the changing culture will scoff that such a statement is idealistic and the mere mouthings of a social theorist. But analogous to the child whose performance of a simple skill is enhanced by the opportunity to observe and imitate the technique of a proficient adult, the native has demonstrated repeatedly that he can master new ways given a suitable model and some encouragement. Equally important is breadth of perspective. Successful adaptation to Western culture does not bring instant happiness, as many natives tend to believe. Accident, illness, death, and bereavement, unrequited love, unemployment, poverty, jealousy, adultery, and theft are common to all cultures and must be expected as personal disappointments, even if some material advantages are achieved. The native view of the white man's world. Most Alaskan natives have either a distorted or a partial concept of the land outside. Textbooks available to elementary-age children depict tree-lined streets and neat houses of middle-class suburbia, where a uniformed mailman drops daily mail into a household slot. A gardener trims lawns and hedges, and children are cautioned against the dangers of playing games in the streets. Children and adults alike are conditioned via motion pictures to the sophisticated life of New York penthouse apartments, with smartly dressed residents entertaining at lavish parties. Fast cars race freeways. Picnickers test the merits of cigarettes beside lazy brooks, or the adventure-bound ski over foam or down thrilling slopes. Teenagers drive their own cars and rock and roll to torrid beats in a succession of nightclubs. Beautiful clothes, fashionable hairstyles, kitchen and bath conveniences are commonplace, and the overall impression is one of great opulence. Widely sold sports car magazines, home magazines, and fashion periodicals all reinforce this image. Of those whites who come to Alaska to live, the native sees little to radically alter his preconception. White teachers live in government housing, replete with kitchen aids, including dishwashers, washing machines and dryers, and pantries stocked with a year's supply of costly tinned food. Virtually all drive motorized equipment of some sort, a personal airplane, an auto, a snowgo. Even the missionary homes of today are comfortably appointed. Along the coast, white man usually maintains, even for mere sport, a better boat with a more powerful engine than the native can afford for his subsistence. Even anthropologists, whose mission is active participation, come better dressed and equipped with obviously expensive equipment and are observed to maneuver with the resident whites for the hot water baths and washing privileges. At least 100 years of experience in dealing with whites, regardless of Russian, U.S., or other background, have given the native the ability to appraise personality differences among whites, a skill that many whites conversely lack in judging the natives with whom they are working. Whites are appraised for what they are: untrustworthy, get-rich-quick exploiters, social misfits who are successful in their hometowns, do-gooders whose mission is messianic, either in religion or social welfare, and the occasional solid citizen who comes to stay. The first groups may attract temporary admirers for the thrill of association or the potentials of financial gain. Community respect and support is slowly but surely accorded the white who quietly moves in, takes up his job, whether teaching or preaching, community service or individual employment, and minds his own business. Yet the native considers all these outsiders as unusual migrants. In the event of mixed marriage, it is usually the wife who adapts to the white's ways and thereby betters her standard of living, rather than the white husband who adopts the native culture. In summary, Western technology, as the native has been exposed to it by photographic aids, produces a markedly higher standard of living. When the native visits big cities such as Anchorage or Juneau, his early impressions are again reinforced by traffic signals, elevators, fine restaurants, hotels, TV, and the many cars. Those who go to the lower 48 to attend school for hospitalization or specialized training reiterate the contrasts. The reaction of Alaskan villagers to these contrasts is varied. Aging informants whose memories teem with stories of old times are genuinely sincere in saying that their lot is far better today than before the white man came. They now have the benefits of medical aid, monetary aid from various government agencies, and increased physical comforts, including electricity, fuel oil stoves, and emergency food available on credit from a well-stocked store. Toilet paper and tissues, Kleenex, outboard motors, sewing thread and steel needles, cotton cloth, sugarcanes and containers, all are marked advances brought by modern technology. If their education was limited to 3 or 4 years, then grounding in the three R's at least provided them with spoken English and an ability to hold day labor jobs. By combining subsistence skills for daily food and some wage labor, they were able in early maturity to build better houses, to acquire guns and motors, and to become eligible for Social Security payments. Maturing young adults and teenagers have been divorced from learning survival skills. Youth, the time for learning material traits by imitation and close cooperation with the mature adults, has been by law and by custom spent in school. The education provided in this period has been largely the same as for middle-class whites in the lower 48. American history, basketball, block play, geography, and allied subjects provide global perspective and are essential as a foundation for advanced college and technical schools and for the use of leisure time. They do not equip a youth to repair his snow-go 90 miles from home, nor train him to fish and hunt, let alone provide him with the education sufficient to become the social worker, the nurse, the teacher and doctor, the important permanent jobs that pay well in northern lands. High school graduates find that their education is substandard. Only exceptional young people are successful in finding wage employment as clerks, stenographers, draftsmen, and mechanics. The experience of the majority is sufficient to convince many young people now in school that education is not worth the effort. Repeatedly, they say school is hard work, and lacking the certainty of permanent positions, they fail to prepare themselves for the modern competitive job market. Native values in white man's world. Native peoples throughout the world seek to attain the material values of Western society. As the theme of this conference, this statement has been repeatedly made by many field workers and merits only brief elaboration here. The native wants monetary security, a continuous inflow of sufficient money to buy food, clothing, fuel, and equipment, plus a few luxuries. Second to these essentials, he wants a bank account as a hedge against misfortune. He wants a mail-order credit card providing the pay-as-you-go privileges that are not now as freely available as at the trading posts of yesteryear. He wants the cash reserve that will enable him to purchase supplies a year ahead at cheaper than local prices and have them shipped by supply boats. He wants insurance on his house against the danger of fire and loss of all his worldly possessions. He wants running water and sewage disposal and a house with interior partitions for privacy. In short, he wants a dream, a future, a goal towards which to work. Unlike middle-class Americans elsewhere, he does not dream of a vacation in Europe, two cars, or a swimming pool. They are beyond his scope.